Hi, podcasters. This is Andy Studna, Associate Editor for Applied Clinical Trials, and I'm here today with our Editor-in-Chief, Lisa Henderson. For today's episode of the ACT podcast, we are speaking with Dr. Shalon Begg, VP of Oncology for Science 37.
Shalon recently joined Science 37 in March 2022, and prior to that, he spent over 11 years and counting at UT Southwestern Medical Center. During his time there, he served as assistant and associate professor of internal medicine, director of GI medical oncology, and is currently an adjunct associate professor. In addition to his experience in academia, Shalon has also in-depth experience as a clinical trial investigator and a strong background in clinical trial design and execution. So thank you for joining us today, Shalon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, thank you, Shalon. As Lisa said in her intro, you're obviously extremely accomplished and active in the oncology field. So what made you choose this field of study?
Yeah, thanks for those kind words. When I entered my medicine training, I had an open mind. I wasn't gung-ho on any one specific field. And I think in hindsight, it was a series of patient interactions that impacted me and I found extremely rewarding and fulfilling. And the more I dipped my toes into the oncology field, I felt that it was one of the most rapidly growing fields in medicine, rapidly evolving new treatments, completely different outlook than what I had initially thought. And here I am. I knew that this field was changing very rapidly, and I wanted to be part of that change.
So for the patient piece, what did that look like as an impact for you?
A lot of people who are not close to the oncology space, and myself before I got into this space, ask, why would you choose a field in oncology? People die, people are suffering, and why do you want to make that your day-to-day? Mm-hmm. Well, the reality in an oncologist's day is very different. I think a lot of people, especially when we are thinking about how the cancer world is depicted in media and what we remember about people who talk about it, yes, I mean, there is a certain degree of suffering. There is a certain degree of burden for family members and people who have cancer. But that's just a small component of the entire journey that someone with cancer is and their families are going through. And the rewarding aspect for me has been being part of that journey and helping them through that journey and then helping them answer a lot of the questions that people have at the time that they are diagnosed and they feel that the rug has been pulled out from under them. And people don't realize the gratitude and how fulfilling those patient interactions can be for their oncologists and their oncologist teams. And I have been impacted by my patients in the way I approach my day-to-day and my family and my work and those aspects. And I feel that that's helped me evolve. And I'm sure my colleagues would agree, and they can go back and think about those episodes that help make them better, better people, better doctors, better family members.
Thank you for sharing that. You have published on reducing the time to trial activation at an NCI-designated cancer center. And being that that is a large topic of discussion among our readers and listeners, can you share how you approach that?
Yeah, I view the trial activation process as how a protocol becomes a trial, sort of like how a bill goes through the entire approval system through our congressional systems. And similar to that process, it can take time and it can take money and it takes resources. And the time and money and resources that it takes varies based on what type of center is involved. A lot of the cancer centers or the NCI designated cancer centers or the larger cancer centers that may be academic are set up as a matrix organization and they're part of a larger organization. And many of the steps that go into activating a clinical trial from scientific and ethics review to budgets and contract and coverage analysis and sort of the informatics needs in terms of integrating them into the electronic health records. Those are formed by many different individuals in sort of this matrix. And whenever you have a process, which is a matrix in this way, you have an environment that leads to challenges in terms of moving a specific protocol along, and that can sometimes cause delays. And those delays are very critical. They delay the completion of the trial. They delay the approval of that drug. It has implications on cash flow for the organizations that are running the trials. And most importantly, it delays access to medications that patients are often eagerly waiting for. So the way we approached it is we actually employed a Six Sigma black belt specialist who came in, and we were able to get people within the cancer center and outside of the cancer center and investigators all into a room. And we started to map out the process that our organization had in trial activation. And first of all, it was great to get everyone in a room because those folks knew each other and had been working together, but I don't think they'd ever been in the room at the same time. And just the process of mapping out the activation led to a bunch of ideas. And those were like implemented by the time that group disbanded or left the room that day. And we also identified some processes that could be run in parallel as opposed to sequentially. And then we put together some teams to operationalize those. But when you think about activating clinical trials, there it's not a problem where you can just throw more effort at and expect it to resolve, because there are many departments that are very critical to the activation process that need to do their diligence, and that has implications for patient safety and on the financial well-being of the program and the whole operations of the trial. Like, you don't want to activate a trial that has some footnote which is requiring equipment that we may not have, right? And having this process that can go through the protocol with a fine-tooth comb and identify those is really, really important for the success of the trial. So getting everyone in the room together, mapping out those processes, coming up with some short-term steps that we came up with, and changing some of the operational steps, which we moved into making them run in parallel as much as we could, did have an impact on our time to activation. And the unintended consequence of getting the group together and disseminating its findings was that the time trial activation became a shared goal across the organization, and everybody knew what they were looking at and how the stuff that may be sitting on their queue has other impacts, and it really helped bring the team together.
Thank you, Shalon. So similar to Lisa's last question, you know, this is another area that's been talked a lot about in our industry, and for good reason: diverse representation in clinical trials. So how can sites ensure that diverse representation?
When I think about diverse representation, what I want to see is whether the people who enrolled on a specific clinical trial or the people that a specific organization is enrolling on clinical trials represent the people who suffer from that disorder or that disease. And if there's a disconnect between that, that means that those trials results are not going to be generalizable. And in the US, we live in a diverse and heterogeneous society, and we need our clinical trials to represent that. One of the reasons it's been challenging to enroll a representative patient population to clinical trials has been around clinical trial access, because most of the clinical trials are performed at large cancer programs that are academic or a lot of very high functioning community programs where they have dedicated clinical trial infrastructure. But most of the cancer patients are seen in community centers and community clinics, who don't have the infrastructure to support clinical trials. And just that access challenge leads to challenges in enrolling a representative patient population. So if a specific cancer center, most of the NCI designated cancer centers are in urban areas, they all have catchment areas that are a few miles or a few dozen miles around their mothership, so as to speak. And that's where they're enrolling patients from. And think about the people who walk into those cancer centers and those organizations. They're more likely to be insured. They're more likely to be urban. They're more likely to be young. And just from that factor, they are limited by the type of people who they can enroll onto the clinical trials. So I think access to clinical trials is one aspect. And it's important for sponsors and sites to realize that they need to make sure that their trials are available at the areas where a diverse group of people are seen for their clinical care. That can include safety net hospitals, that can include community health providing centers and practices in non-urban areas. The other aspect is, we understand that there are lots of biases when it comes to offering specific clinical trials to patients. And it's important for the providers and clinical investigators to always ask if somebody would like to be part of a clinical trial and not make any presumptions. And unless we include that in our day-to-day conversations with our patients, we're going to miss out on identifying people who can enroll on those clinical trials. And at the end of the day, it's really about clear, full-throated endorsement from the leaderships of these organizations that this is a value that they abide by. And they want people enrolled on clinical trials who represent the communities that they serve. And that will force everyone, I guess, downstream, I should say, to those leaders to think about ways to change the way they are operationalizing those clinical trials. And that can mean talking to people where clinical trials are not the priority. Like if you think about safety net hospitals, their primary goal is to deliver patient care to an underserved group of people in their area. And how do we come up with a process where we tell them that providing clinical trials is part of delivering care for those patients, but there are infrastructure needs and cost and resources that are required. And that's why this endorsement from leadership and this endorsement from sponsors and patient advocates is really important to normalize the conversation around clinical trials and make this part of our day-to-day conversations.
That's a really excellent point. You're a member of ASCO. Do you have these conversations about normalizing that conversation, bringing it into somebody's infrastructure?
Having a discussion on representation is something which everybody is paying a lot of attention to. This is coming from the NCI. This is coming from the FDA. The FDA has put in guidance for trial sponsors to make sure that they have a diversity action plan in their protocols, where they need to document how they will ensure that their trial will enroll a diverse and representative patient population. A lot of cancer centers know that they're not going to get a free pass in enrolling a non-diverse patient population. And that's because of a lot of these changes and a lot of the national discussion that's going on around equity and equity in clinical care and equity in clinical trials is part of that conversation. So the ASCO and ACCC recently came up with some training for sites around training the staff at sites for how to approach clinical trials in an equitable manner, in a sensitive manner. And one of the stories that we talked about in one of our articles was a diet study for cancer. And diet and cancer is this, we get a lot of questions from our patients about diet and cancer and what can I eat and what can I not eat. And we were looking at this trial that was looking at a specific diet as a treatment for cancer. And that was a wonderful trial for us to enroll and to enroll on. And we knew that patients would receive it very well. And someone raised the question around, these are prepackaged meals that were sent to participants. And someone raised the question on, well, is this ethnically appropriate food? For a second, I had to pause and understand what that even meant. I mean, if you're packaging pesto pasta for a group of people where that's not part of their regular diet, you're going to expect some compliance issues because meals and food is something which is shared in a lot of cultures, and the type of food that's being eaten is a family affair. And how can we come in with solutions which can be acceptable to our participants and make them representative? So the conversation is happening, and we're seeing more and more people talk about this. We're seeing sponsors prioritize this. We're seeing cancer centers prioritize this and national organizations prioritize this. And I'm seeing a lot of positive effects coming out of those conversations.
Excellent. Thanks for sharing that background and those crucial points about cultural sensitivities toward diet. That would have been something I would have maybe not thought about, but having it brought up really makes you think about it again. So thanks for that backstory.
LabVantage Solutions is a global leader in enterprise laboratory software solutions that improve customer outcomes by transforming data into knowledge. Its intelligent LIMS platform features advanced analytics, state-of-the-art AI, and mixed reality technologies that enable revolutionary advances in the pharmaceutical industry by drawing greater insights from broad data sets. For more information, visit labvantage.com.
So now we're going to get into your new role. You just started with Science 37 in March. So what led you to that, Shalene?
I spend a lot of my time thinking about clinical trial operations and clinical trial access. And for a lot of the reasons that we talked about earlier today in this conversation, it was apparent to me that the current clinical trial infrastructure doesn't fit the type of patients who need those clinical trials the most. And I started to think about how we can use clinical informatics and large data sets for drug approvals. There was a lot of work around real-world data for FDA drug approvals that I was following very closely as well. And I started to examine the decentralized clinical trial model, which was really coming together because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And we noticed that the technology is now there. The regulatory agencies are pushing for clinical trials to be more accessible beyond the traditional clinical trial sites and to be moved closer to where patients are. And the sponsors are waking up to the fact that this is a solution which can really help them with completing their trials because trials are taking too long and patients who need those trials do not have access to those trials. And there are a lot of wonderful organizations that are doing fantastic work. Some of the work that I've been involved in with the American Society of Clinical Oncology and the MITRE Corporation was to use their M-Code initiative to screen patients for clinical trials. And the M-Code initiative is a common set of data elements that ASCO came up with a few years ago, which is a guideline for sites to include oncology data elements in a structured field in their EHR so that can enable interoperability and data sharing in a more harmonized way. And I was thinking more about how to apply that for cancer clinical trial matching. And that led me to sort of the conclusion that this is the right time for us to double down on decentralized trials in oncology and see how we can help make it work in this space. And Science 37 had been working in the decentralized space for more than 5 or 6 years pre-COVID, and they had experience in cancer clinical trial screening studies and cancer treatment studies, and they have all the components that we need. And I felt that my interests in clinical trial operations and having worked as a clinical investigator will combine well with their expertise in trial delivery informatics, and we can try to help make decentralized trials work in the oncology space.
So staying with the topic of decentralized trials, Science 37 just did a survey of oncology executives around the use of DCTs. So can you just give us an overview of the results, and did any of them surprise you?
Yeah, so this survey had been going on for a couple of years where the oncology executives would be surveyed to understand their perceptions and their plans for incorporating decentralized clinical trial tools into their protocols. And this was the first year that these oncology executives were saying that they were more likely to incorporate decentralized tools into their protocols than they were to run traditional clinical trials, i.e. trials without any decentralized tools. And And I think that's really monumental because, as I said, this trial, the survey has been going on for a couple of years, and this is the first year more people are trying to incorporate decentralized tools. So I feel that we're in a watershed moment where a lot of the reservations that people had in terms of decentralized trials and oncology are being addressed, partly because of what we've seen can happen during the COVID-19 pandemic, but also because of a lot of guidance that's coming from regulatory agencies to try and make this a possibility. A lot of some of the reservations were, well, our drugs are too burdensome, or patients may be too ill, and patients really want to come in to see their doctor, and how will we address that? And we know that there are a lot of medications that can lend themselves well for a decentralized approach. We know that regulatory agencies are providing guidance to help make this better. And because of the adoption of telemedicine into our clinical care, we know that there are certain components of our clinical trials which we can decentralize using telemedicine and home-based approaches and mobile nurses who can come to the patient's home. So I think that there's this watershed moment, and that really reinforced my reading of the field and added sort of some more energy into this pursuit, because at the same time, we also know that trials are taking longer, as I mentioned earlier, and there are a lot of papers that are written in terms of the number of cancer trials that are not meeting their milestones. And we're always going to have this mismatch where most people with cancer are going to be seen at sites that don't have robust clinical trial access. We're seeing some sites that have an abundance of trials, and we're seeing a lot of sites that don't have access to clinical trials. And that's where decentralized clinical trials can really help make a difference in bringing these clinical trials to the communities where patients are being seen. And that's why I feel that being part of this conversation and understanding how oncologists are approaching clinical trial access and how sponsors are approaching these is really important. When we start talking about decentralized trials, I think it can be overwhelming for the quote-unquote typical oncologist to know what that can mean for their patients. And we know that, you know, there are many different clinical trials based on the type of intervention that's being done, based on the side effect profiles, if it's a drug that's being tested, based on where those patients are being seen and what the individual needs of those patients are. And we're seeing a lot of sponsors incorporate decentralized tools in their protocols. And we're seeing some completely decentralized clinical trials that are activated in a site-less manner. So through one budget and one contract, the sponsor can have the trial open across the country. And I think the future is going to be a more agile hybrid clinical trial where we will be able to let the patient decide where they'd like to get their treatment on the clinical trial. I think we're on the way to that space where, you know, the patient can see the schedule of events on a trial and say, I'll do this at home and I'll do this over here. And we can customize their experience on that clinical trial. So I'd like us to move from trying to decide on how to deploy decentralized tools at the protocol level and start moving that to the patient level. And I think that transition will be extremely exciting.
That does sound really exciting. And my question was going to be around your perspective of hybrid trials, but I think you've made that abundantly clear. And knowing your experience as a clinical oncologist and doing all this research, that you're a fan of bringing these technologies to the patient. And you feel that your fellow oncologists, they're on board with this? I mean, you mentioned there might be some hesitancy, but how are you addressing any types of hesitancy?
Well, whenever there's a new paradigm, we're going to have some early adopters and we're going to have some late adopters. And the fact is that this model for decentralized trials is challenging the existing model to some extent. It's challenging how we think about taking care of our patients. It's challenging how we think about clinical care versus clinical research. And it may take a while for everyone to come behind this. And part of the responsibility that we have is to find those use cases in oncology where field is ready to adopt these tools. It's never going to be a solution for every clinical trial. There will always be trials that need to be done, for example, in the hospital, in the intensive care unit. And those we would not be looking to decentralize, but there may be components that we can do to help reduce the patient's participation burden. And I feel there are people who are sitting on the sidelines, and we need those people sitting on the sidelines, and we need people to be challenging us to make sure that the answers are correct, because at the end of the day, we want to make sure that the solutions that we are coming up with are safe and patient-centric, and help us give access for those clinical trials to the people who need it and help us get these trials done. And I think about precision medicine clinical trials as being ready and ripe for the use of decentralized tools, because most sites considered precision medicine studies, or most precision medicine studies, as rare tumor studies, and they may end up only enrolling a couple of patients. And it's burdensome for them we talked about trial activation, to activate many clinical trials that may not enroll a lot of patients. And as a result, we're seeing a lot of trial sites say no to precision medicine trials, which affects the approval process for that, and most importantly, limits the access of those new medications to those patients. And I think that decentralized trials have a huge role to play in making precision medicine trials accessible across the country. We're also seeing more long-term follow-up clinical trials. We're seeing the liquid biopsy space growing very rapidly for looking at people for molecularly minimal residual disease and for molecular profiling. And a lot of those studies are ready for incorporating decentralized clinical trials.
Thank you, Shalon. That just about does it for the questions that we had planned out. Before we end, is there anything else that you would like to add or dive into that maybe the questions didn't hit on?
No, this has been a wonderful conversation. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and to your audience. And I'd like the take-home message to be that decentralized clinical trials are a tool to help democratize clinical trial access. And there's a lot of learning that we all have to do in this space, as it is in oncology in general. And we're really living in an extremely exciting time when it comes to delivering outstanding cancer care for our patients.